Accession number 30018, reel 15.
John Farley, reel 15. So the chap is going to do his first vertical takeoff. He's not going to be on his own because you've gone to air traffic and you're on the RT. And you say to him as he leaves the ground, that's fine, less power. Because you've briefed them that the first thing you want them to do after they leave the ground, apart from keep it flat, is bring the throttle back a bit, because you're no interested in the height they go up to, you want to go back down again. And you can take it from me, you will not move the throttle back too fast. You'll be apprehensive and you'll underplay it, and the airplane will go on up and up, and I should say, less power, and eventually it'll start coming down again. And I'll say that's a nice rate of descent. It's coming down, you're 30 feet up, because you've never seen this before. And you're 25 feet up, or 15 feet up. Keep it coming. No, don't pull the nose up, you know, because you've raised the nose. And when it gets to the ground, not before, but the instant it does touch, I want you to chop the throttle. I don't mean take it off a little, because think about this. As you come down, your thrust equals your weight. You're not accelerating downwards, you're drifting downwards. So the whole weight of the aeroplane is supported by the engine. But it has got some momentum. It's this 8-ton lorry that is rolling down your drive without the brakes on. It's going to hit the house, in this case the ground. And when it does hit, the undercarriage has to get rid of that momentum. It doesn't have to get rid of the weight of the aeroplane, it has to get rid of the momentum it's got. And of course it will do that, because that's what it's designed to do. However, it's got springs. And even though we've got a self-shortening leg in the main leg, the outrigger's got springs and the nose has got springs. And if you don't take the thrust off, those springs will push the aeroplane back up into the air, and you've got the whole thing to do all over again. So it'll go bouncing around, you follow? Unless you chop the throttle. So teach them to chop the throttle. Most people probably went back up to 6 inches or something, and then, you know, got the power off, and a bit of what we called a power bounce on their first thing. Now, as soon as you've got it back on the ground again, I want you to taxi back in, shut it down, get out, we'll have a cup of coffee and we'll talk about it. Because everybody who went out to do this the first time probably felt they'd make a mess of it, or couldn't do it, or be the first person not to be able to do it. When they've done it once, they're in a totally different frame of mind. They go from being underconfident to being totally overconfident in a flash. They want to go out and do it again, do an air show now, you know, sort of thing. And you've got to stamp on that. And the way you stamp on it, of course, as with any instructional thing, is you don't make a big thing about the things they've done right, you make a big thing about what they've done wrong. And so you say, yeah, you got that all right, but you didn't take the throttle off fast enough or whatever, or you pulled the stick back like I told you not to just before the ground. So I want you to go out and do it all again, but this time do not pull a stick back as you're coming down towards the ground, and chop that throttle a bit faster than you did before. So they go and do it again, another press up. Get them back in again, another cup of coffee, all right? Well, you're still going up to about 25 feet, aren't you? Now, can't you just stop this by about 10 feet? You know how far you've got to pull your left hand back now. So they go off, and by the end of 4 or 5 press-ups, they can just go straight up, there's not a wobble, and straight back down again, and they've been up to about 6 feet and they're on the ground. Lovely. Right, that's enough for today. Go home, go to the hotel, go down a pub, whatever. Tomorrow morning, we'll carry on. And then you just work through that process that I described earlier, where you get them next to go up into the hover and hold their height, 50 feet up perhaps, while they're learning this throttle thing. Get back down on the ground again, another cup of coffee. Go back out again, up the hover, this time now lower the nose, 10 degrees. Move forward, 50 knots on the airspeed, raise the nose, stop it. So one new thing per sortie. If you had a two-seater, which we didn't have, and later on when we did get two-seaters, and you've got an instructor with a guy, then yes, you could make a lot progress a lot faster and do several things because you had a way out. But in those days, I believe it was absolutely right that we aimed, we set it up to make it as safe as possible, and we never hurt anybody doing one of these things. I mean, the odd outrigger got a ding or something like that, and the odd bit of pride was hurt, but nobody ever got injured. And that says a lot, really, for this step-by-step process of converting people. I mean, we did, I think, over 90 pilots in the end before, of the Royal Air Force and the Marine Corps, before the two-seater was introduced into service. And they were all done using that sort of approach. We didn't do them all ourselves. When I said we, I mean the Harrier program did 90-odd blokes, because the technique we used for the Royal Air Force First Squadron was that, and the RAF decided to convert a Hunter squadron in total to, and they froze all the postings for 18 months. Everybody knew each other very well, ground crew and air crew. They knew who were the good guys and the weaker ones. They took their four best guys, and they became the HCT, the Harrier Conversion Team. They came to Dunsfold, and they were given by Duncan Simpson the same treatment that I've just described that I'd done these two Marines earlier. And having absorbed all of that, the HCT, the four guys, went back to the rest of their mates on the squadron and regurgitated it all and converted the rest of their squadron. So that was how it was done in those early days.
Given even that programme that you've mentioned, John, and how you went about it and how it was continued on in the same kind of structure, have there ever been any pilots who've not grasped it and not been able to handle that, or has it always been something that people can evolve to take on board?
Well, certainly, when we were doing the single-seat conversions, I'm not aware of anybody who has failed. I dare say, in fact, I'm quite sure that the guys were all fairly high-quality guys, or they wouldn't have been offered the conversion. They were good, sound guys. No, we didn't have anybody fail.
So it was still instilling this idea into them. I mean, the main thing that strikes me is this idea of the minute that you're taken off is this awareness of what's going on
around you.
Is something that would be unusual to them, would it not, from what they've done before, in a sense?
Well, I don't know about that. I think fighter pilots are used to looking around normally for the enemy and this sort of thing. So yes, you had to be... You might not have been so alert in the circuit normally. Now you had to bring that sort of alertness into your circuit work. And I don't think there was any real problem with that. I mean, we briefed them specifically. Look out the side. When you teach people instrument flying in ordinary airplanes, there was something called a scan of the instruments that you were taught. You didn't just stare at one instrument or occasionally look around the cockpit. There was a structure to it. You check your attitude, you make sure it's right, then you look at your height, then you look at your rate of climb and descent, then you look at your head, you know, and you go around and you go back to the attitude, and if one of the other things is wrong, you adjust the attitude to get, you know. So there was a scan, there was a process, a mental process that people were supposed to go through, and you taught the same thing about hovering. Now, I certainly never converted without a two-seater anybody who hadn't had some hovering in a helicopter. All of those one squadron guys, I think they were given 5 hours in a chopper with a chopper instructor. Again, not to teach them to become chopper pilots, but to teach them the visual cues. So we were careful, we did it carefully, and we made a bit of a meal of it, if you like, but better that than lose aeroplanes.
You also mentioned that at the time you were writing the pilot's notes for it. I mean, it was at that stage, how advanced were you along the road with that, and what did that actually entail to write pilot's notes for an aircraft?
Well, pilot's notes for an aeroplane, of course, have got a variety of information. I mean, it's called the aircrew manual now, in the way that things change. I mean, the rat catcher is called the rodent exterminator or something, you know. Well, it was pilot's notes in the old days, and they were little blue books. And in them, you had a nice, meaty description of the aircraft systems, its fuel system, electrical system, and hydraulic system, whatever. Then there was a bit on handling. This is how you do a takeoff. This is the trim setting. These are the checks you do before takeoff and so on. There was a bit on cruising or climbing and the climbing speeds to be used, you know, the sort of information that you needed. And it was all succinctly put into a little booklet, and some emergency procedures and a few pictures of the cockpit with numbered switches and dials on it. Well, as aeroplanes got more complicated, and certainly by the time the Harrier came along, the pilot's notes had become the aircrew manual. And this was, as befitted a modern aeroplane, which was much more complicated, it had got a lot of technical description in it. Most of which came naturally from the people who designed the systems. You might need to do a little bit of tweaking of that to put it in sort of pilot speak here and there, but the system stuff was factual information and you were going to get it. The handling, however, had got to be written down and described, and of course there was a lot more handling to VSTOL than there was to conventional flying. And so I was determined that I would write some simple to understand handling notes, and yet also try and anticipate the sort of what today people call FAQs, frequently asked questions, don't they, you know. So a well-written handling chapter in the pilot's notes, in my view, preempts questions, you know. People are thinking of something, and the next thing they know, they read the next line and the thing's answered for them. So you need to put a fair bit of work into that, because they want to be clear and concise, but you also want to cover a lot of detail, so you have to think about how you put this lot together. And I was interested in this. I mean, I've been flying jump jets then for, this is 68, so I'd started in 60. I've been flying them for 4 years, and I reckon I knew a little bit about how I did it. That's a test pilot's job, to be able to talk about how they do something. A service pilot's job, whether it be an airline pilot or a military pilot, their job is to do it properly. And a lot of them are very good at doing it properly, and they have no idea how they do it. And they wouldn't necessarily, without extra training, make good training pilots, good instructor pilots. They are just natural. I mean, some guys naturally take to a skateboard. Could they tell you or I how to do it? No, they've just got talent, natural. That's no good as a test pilot, that's no good as an instructor. So the job of somebody writing the pilot's notes, in my view, is to try and help somebody through this learning process.
Did you feel, obviously, with doing that as well, that again, your background with the apprenticeship, the test pilot work, and as a service pilot as well, helped in that?
There's no question. I mean, when I did a lot of conversion flying on the aeroplane, not all of it was single-seaters, but later on when we had our own GV2L two-seater demonstrator, well, I say our own, civil registered, paid for by the company, our piece of kit. We didn't have to ask the ministry, we could put somebody in the back of that and teach them to fly it, or the front of it. I did a lot of demonstration flying and instructional flying, and as far as I'm concerned, my course at the Central Flying School, where I was taught how to be a flying instructor, was much more value to me at that point in my career than my Empire Test Pilot School course that taught me how to test an aeroplane. I mean, the two jobs are quite different, and I was always very grateful that I'd had this instructional experience, and had a base from which to take it forward.
So obviously we're at the kind of point with about 1968 with the aircraft. Were you working on the G problem for most of the time until it came into service, or had that been solved and there were anything else you had?
No, I would think we had the spec point on G solved probably, it was about the middle of 68, I'd have to check, but no, it once we realised that we got to do it and we started flying these different fixes, it was only a month or two, and yes, we had that cracked.
So was there another stage before it came into service that you had to be involved in?
Oh, yes, there were lots of things that had to be done. I mean, we have grossly oversimplified it. If anybody thinks we just had to get enough G out of it, there are all sorts of flying qualities criteria that have to be met. There's all sorts of performance measurements. Rates of climb, how are you going to descend it? The pilot's notes includes a lot of graphs these days in how to calculate the likely performance of an airplane. We had all the different stores that had to be carried. We had all the different stores, and now you're changing the outside shape of the airplane. We had all the different stores that had to be released without even worrying about whether you're going to aim them. They mustn't bang into the airplane. They mustn't fly about alongside you. The carriage and release trials, as they were called, were very complex, and probably more complex than any other aeroplane to date that had gone into the Royal Air Force Service, because there were many stores that they wanted to deliver from this aeroplane, bombs, rockets. We had the guns to sort out. There's an awful lot of development work to be done.
With something like the carriage release, is that something that will be filmed so you can see what's actually happening on the outside of the aircraft?
Absolutely. You'll have what's called a chase aeroplane with a photographer in it, and he'll be taking cine film. He'll be suitably positioned, probably a fraction lower than you and out to one side a bit, and so he can got a clear view of underneath the wing of the stores and so on. You will have, we call them cheek cameras and fin cameras and little tiny... We are talking cameras, not digital. It was all film in those days, which will be fitted to the aeroplane, and you will switch on and will record what's going on. There's also actual instrumentation traces that are recording the loads and control positions and things. You know, it's the standard data gathering exercise. These stores today on a high-speed jet fighter are not released, although we called it carriage and release. They're not released. They are forced away from the airplane. They are punched away by what are called ERUs, ejection release units. Sorry, ejector, I beg your pardon. Ejector release units. These are plungers that come out from the pylon that push the store away, and the plungers are operated by explosive charges. So when you select the bomb off, when you press the bomb release button, then these ERU charges will fire. The hook will come out and it'll be opened, the release hook, all simultaneously, and the thing will be pushed away from the aeroplane. There was all the long-range tanks developed. We had a spec point which was 1,200 miles without flight refueling. That's a long way. That's further than the Tridents in BEA could go at that time. So there was an example of a spec point which the Royal Air Force wanted. The only way we could get that range was by putting on very large tanks. There were 330-gallon tanks, and increasing the wing area. We unbolted the wing tips, which were outboard of the little kiddie wheels and were designed to be removable, and bolted on outsize tips that had more area. And the aerodynamic efficiency of a wing goes up as you increase its aspect ratio. That is, if you fix the front to rear distance of the wing and make it span greater. That is what we did with putting these bigger wing tips on. They were called ferry wing tips. So we increased the aerodynamic efficiency of the wing. That increased its performance in the cruise. And the idea was that you put the ferry wing tips on, you put the ferry tanks on, you deployed the aeroplanes to wherever they got to go in theatre or outside new theatre, and then you took the tanks off and put the combat tips back on, and off you got on. So yeah, there was lots of development work that had to be done. Once the RAF got launched then with its operational aeroplane, there were several fields of development. The first was that the United States Marines, of course, started to actually get their production aircraft. You remember we discussed how they came along and looked at the aeroplane some years earlier. Once they got their production aircraft, they wanted to deploy it from ships. And, not aircraft carriers, but ships with flat decks. And they called them LPH, landing platform helicopters. And this interest of the Marine Corps in flying from ships was mirrored in a small way by the way the Royal Air Force started flying from ships as well. The company, Hawkers, had led the way naturally in before the Marines or the Royal Air Force flew from ships looking at that use of the aircraft, because that was one of the big advantages of VSTOL, especially the vertical landing bit. It meant that you could fly from quite austere ships. So we had always felt that there was more development to be done in making, shall we say, a specialised version of the aeroplane to fly from ships, which in the end turned into something called the Sea Harrier. But before that happened, there were a couple of things that are probably worth discussing. The Marine Corps really got heavily into flying from ships, and they did very well with it. The sort of modifications that were necessary to fly the aeroplane from ships were negligible. We're talking of adding sort of tie down areas on the wingtip outriggers and the main wheel and so on, because when ships operate as floating airfields, the only thing that keeps the equipment on the deck is friction between the rubber tires and the deck. And when a ship, you know, rolls about all over the place or goes through rough water, and if you've got seawater and oil and everything else floating around on the deck, sometimes the friction is not that much, and you really need to lash everything down to the deck. So the most significant modification was this need to provide external lashing points. There were some small changes necessary to the NAVATAC system, which in those days was quite an early inertial platform system, one of those devices that has a stabilised platform, has got accelerometers on it in all three axes, and if you connect this to a computer, the computer can calculate from the accelerations in the three axes. One integration, of course, will give you velocity, and a second integration will give you position, and so you could get the accurate position of the aeroplane from one of these inertial platforms. It didn't need any GPS satellites, which hadn't happened then. It didn't need any radio transmissions to come in or go out. It was a totally self-contained thing called an inertial platform. And what a wonderful thing that was for the military at that time. Gave them an unprecedented level of accuracy. We're talking, in those days, in the early 70s, we're talking of an accuracy which had a drift of about a mile or a mile and a half per hour. Now, you might say, well, that's not very accurate. You know, I don't know where I am to a mile and a half after an hour. But when you start looking outside of an aeroplane that's doing 400 or 500 knots, you know, a mile is nothing. So, although today such accuracies would be laughed upon or laughed at, and were no good for weapon aiming as such, they were excellent for pilot navigation. I mean, better than anything we'd ever had. So these inertial platforms have to be aligned, and this process can take, which means sort of levelled prior to use. And these sort of things, that process could take a little while, even on a fixed base. If you started moving the aeroplane while the platform was trying to align, it got quite confused. And of course, how are you going to align a platform on a ship when the ship is moving all the time? So there were modifications needed so that they could put a sort of pseudo-stationary input into the aircraft. It was just, you plug this alignment system into the airplane on deck. Other things were done where you could connect up to the ship's inertial platform and get its position from, you know. So, but you know, kid stuff really, not groundbreaking stuff. Then there was this business of doing short takeoffs from ships with a deck that is pitching. Now, we all know how in rough water the front of a ship goes right up in the air and then goes down wallop, you know, and so on. And with a short takeoff, of course, you want to run along the length of the deck, perhaps 400 or 500 feet, to build up a little bit of airspeed over the wing so that it can carry that couple of tons over the vertical takeoff weight that you have the airplane at when you're full of fuel and full of weapons. So what happens if you and me on a Thursday afternoon, we get to the end of the flight deck and it will be pointing down at the water, which is no way to start a trip. So there was this issue of, you've got to be careful of ship motion. Now, you can do one of two things. If you want to fly your airplanes in rough water, you can make them lighter so that you don't have to do a short takeoff or a vertical takeoff, but that has obvious operational limitations in terms of range and payload. Or you can make them a little bit lighter so that you can pull out of the subsequent dive. Or you can do what Doug Taylor, a lieutenant commander in the Royal Navy, suggested, and that is put a curved ramp on the front of the boat, so called the ski jump, so that whenever you exit the deck, you're always going up and away from the water, even if the ship is at that point of maximum bow down. So the angle of the ski jump doesn't have to be more than probably 2 or 3 degrees to guarantee that you, on a big ship, that you will not be pointing down at the water. But we started with a ski jump of just over 6, and we gradually developed Doug Taylor's idea on a trials ramp at RAE Bedford. We built the ramp at Bedford, and this was in 1977, the summer of 77. And by the time we finished the ski jump trials, we got the ski jump up to 20 degrees. And we had become only too well aware that you could get tremendous improvements in aircraft takeoff performance. Now, you might say, well, you're already at max weight, you know, what can you do with a ski jump? Answer, use only half the deck as you run at the ski jump, leaving the other half of the deck free for maintenance activities, landing aeroplanes, getting other aeroplanes ready to fly, whatever. So the ski jump was a brilliant idea. It made the aircraft very much safer. It gave it much greater performance and was much easier to fly. So this work was going on apropos ships.
Could I ask how you finally managed to define what angle the ski deck will be at? What was the...
Yes, it's a good question. What angle should you have the ski jump at? If you look at firing artillery guns over long distances, then any artillery soldier will tell you that you point the barrel up at 45 degrees because this gives you the maximum ballistic range when you just throw something into the loft. In this case, a shell from an artillery piece. And so the theory, which Doug Taylor was well aware of this ballistic part of the trajectory, was going to be a maximum, give you a maximum improvement at 45 degrees. But there was tremendous disadvantages to having a ramp of anything approaching that angle. Like, you had to build it, like it was a huge thing, like it spoilt the nice lines of the boat. It reduced the amount of deck that the captain could have his marching band using and all this sort of stuff. So there were thoughts that we don't really want to get into the ultimate capability from a ski jump. And this law of diminishing returns, which we're all familiar with, where a good idea, as you sort of wind up the volume on the good idea, you realise, well, it is getting a little bit better all the time, but not as much as it was right at the beginning. And to cut a long story short, we found 20 degrees gave you 98, 99% of what you were going to get out of the theoretical maximum, and what's more, at 15 degrees you got most of that as well. So I don't believe there's been a ship, there's so many with ski jumps on now, when Hermes went down to the Falklands it had 12 degree ramp, I think, speaking from memory, but you know what memory's like. But in general, the ramps that have gone onto ships, the Spanish ships, the Spanish Navy have got one as well, and so on, they've been around the 12 to 15 degrees, and that gives you most of the benefits.